Oppenheimer was determined to change all this. In his own field of theoretical physics, he hoped to do for the Institute what he had done for Berkeley in the 1930s, turn it into a world-class center for theoretical physics. He knew the war had suspended engagement in any truly original work. But things were rapidly changing. Today, he told an MIT audience in the autumn of 1947, barely 2 years after the end of hostilities, physics is booming.
Early in April 1947, Abraham Pice, a bright young physicist with a temporary fellowship at the Institute, received a phone call from Berkeley, California. "This is Robert Oppenheimer," the caller told a startled Pice.
"I have just accepted the directorship of the Institute for Advanced Study, and I desperately hope that you will be there next year, so that we can begin building up theoretical physics there."
Flattered, Pice immediately put aside thoughts of joining Bohr in Denmark and agreed.
He would remain at the Institute for the next 16 years, becoming one of Oppenheimer's long-standing confidants.
Pice soon had a chance to observe Oppenheimer in action.
For 3 days in June 1947, 23 of the country's leading theoretical physicists gathered at the Ram's Head Inn, an exclusive resort on Shelter Island at the eastern tip of Long Island. Oppenheimer had taken the lead in organizing the conference.
Among others, he brought Hans Bethe, I.I. Rabi, Richard Feynman, Victor Weisskopf, Edward Teller,
George Uhlenbeck, Julian Zwinger, David Bohm, Robert Marshak, Willis Lamb, and Hendrik Kremers to discuss the foundations of quantum mechanics. With the end of the war, theoretical physicists were finally able to shift their attention back to fundamental issues. One of Oppenheimer's doctoral students, Willis Lamb, gave the first of the conference's many remarkable presentations, outlining what would soon become known as the Lamb shift, which in turn became a key step to a new theory of quantum electrodynamics. Lamb would win a Nobel Prize in 1955 for his work on this topic. Similarly, Rabi gave a groundbreaking talk on nuclear magnetic resonance. Although Carl Darrow, Secretary of the Physical Society, officially chaired the conference, Oppenheimer dominated it. "As the conference went on," Darrow noted in his diary, "the ascendancy of Oppenheimer became more evident. The analysis, often caustic, of nearly every argument, that magnificent English, never marred by hesitation or groping for words, I never heard catharsis used in a discourse on physics, or the clever word mesoniferous, which is probably Oppenheimer's invention. The dry humor, the perpetually recurring comment that one idea or another, including some of his own, was certainly wrong, and the respect with which he was heard."
Similarly, Pice was struck by Oppenheimer's priestly style when speaking before an audience.
"It was as if he were aiming at initiating his audience into nature's divine mysteries."
On the third and last day, Oppenheimer led a discussion of the paradoxical behavior of mesons, a topic he had explored with Robert Serber prior to the war. Pice later remembered Oppenheimer's masterful performance, interrupting at all the right moments with leading questions, summarizing the discussion and stimulating others to think of solutions. "I was sitting next to Marshak," Pice later wrote, "during this discussion, and can still remember how he suddenly got all red in the face. He got up and said, 'Maybe there are two kinds of mesons. One kind is copiously produced, then disintegrates into a different kind which absorbs only weakly.'" In Pice's view, Oppenheimer thus midwifed Marshak's innovative two-meson hypothesis,
a breakthrough which later won the British physicist Cecil F. Powell a Nobel in 1950. The Shelter Island Conference also helped Feynman and Zwinger to work out renormalization theory, an elegant new way to calculate the interactions of an electron with its own or another electromagnetic field. Once again, if Oppenheimer himself was not the author of such discoveries, many of his peers saw him as their great facilitator. Not everyone applauded Oppenheimer's performance. David Bohm recalled thinking that Oppie was talking too much. "He was very fluent with his words," Bohm said, "but there wasn't much behind what he was saying to back up that much talking." Bohm thought his mentor had begun to lose his insightfulness, perhaps simply because he hadn't been doing anything of any substance in physics for many years. "Oppenheimer didn't sympathize with what I was doing in physics," Bohm recalled. "I wanted to question fundamentals, and he felt that one should work on using the present theory, exploiting it, and trying to work out its consequences." Earlier in their relationship, Bohm had had tremendous regard for Oppenheimer. But over time, he found himself agreeing with another friend who had worked with Oppenheimer, Milton Plessett, who expressed the view that Oppie was not capable of genuine originality, but that he is very good at comprehending other people's ideas and seeing their implications. Leaving Shelter Island, Oppenheimer hired a private seaplane to fly him to Boston, where he was scheduled to receive an honorary degree at Harvard.
Victor Weisskopf and several other physicists returning to Cambridge accepted his invitation to join him on the plane.
Halfway there, they ran into a storm, and the pilot decided to land at a Navy base in New London, Connecticut. Civilian aircraft were forbidden to use this airdrome, and as they taxied up to the dock, the pilot could see an angry Navy captain yelling at him. Oppenheimer told the pilot, "Let me handle this." As he stepped off the plane, he announced, "My name is Oppenheimer." The Navy officer gasped and then asked, "Are you the Oppenheimer?" Without missing a beat, Oppie replied, "I am an Oppenheimer." Bowled over to be in the presence of the famous physicist, the officer went out of his way to serve Oppenheimer and his friends tea and cookies, and then sent them on their way to Boston aboard a Navy bus.